Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. The burning of the Confederate capital of Richmond, Virginia in May 1865 did not officially end the Civil War, but it did deal the final crushing blow to the Confederacy. Our guest this week, Nelson Langford, has written a new book on the burning of Richmond. In our conversation, he not only describes the city's fall, but he also explains how its capture sowed the seeds of resentment that Southerners harbored toward the North for the next 100 years. And after that, Andrew Schockett returns to Talking History to comment on the controversy surrounding the White House exposing the name of a CIA agent to the press, thereby endangering the agent's life. As Schockett puts it, such dirty and deadly tricks are not uncommon in history. But first, Dan Roberts continues his A Moment in Time series on Civil War woman spies.
In the summer of 1861, Washington hostess Rose Greenhow helped the infant Confederacy win the First Battle of Manassas at Bull Run Creek.
A Moment in Time with Dan Roberts.
Rose O'Neill Greenhow was born to a slaveholding family in southern Maryland in 1870. As a young woman, she moved to Washington City to live with her aunt, who ran a boarding house in the old Capitol building. She earned the nickname Wild Rose because of her subtle mind and biting tongue. Charming, intelligent, and witty, Rose entertained frequently and cultivated friendships with some of the most powerful political figures of her time, John C. Calhoun, James Buchanan, and William Seward. Rose became one of the most popular and captivating figures in Washington's antebellum society. After she was widowed in 1854, she used her contact and friendships in high places to support herself and her children. Mrs. Greenhow was a well-known anti-abolitionist and gradually came to favor Southern secession. At the onset of the Civil War, she was recruited by Confederate sympathizers to take charge of a Washington spy ring. Using her political connections and perhaps the occasional romantic liaison, Rose began to harvest a treasure of valuable military information. On July 10, 1861, she forwarded important details to General Pierre G.T. Beauregard, whose Confederate forces were assembling at the Manassas Railroad Junction, 30 miles west of the Capitol. This information helped Beauregard rout the Union Army in the first major engagement of the Civil War. Placed under house arrest in August, she continued directing the ring and then was exiled south in June 1862, where she was received as a heroine. Next time, The Spy in Disguise at the University of Richmond. This is Dan Roberts.
Turning to items of historical interest in the news, on Thanksgiving Day 2003, President George Bush visited Baghdad on a surprise visit to the troops. In reviewing the history of such visits, various news reports have found presidential visits to war zones not uncommon. His father visited the troops in Saudi Arabia on Thanksgiving Day 1990 during the first Gulf War. Franklin Roosevelt rendezvoused with Winston Churchill in January 1943 in Casablanca, following Allied victories in North Africa. In December 1952, President Dwight Eisenhower went to Korea to be with the troops, and in October 1966, President Lyndon Johnson did the same in Vietnam. But to connect to the subject of our interview this week, on April 4, 1865, President Abraham Lincoln visited Richmond, Virginia, just 48 hours after Jefferson Davis fled the Capitol. Parts of the city were still in flames. This is Talking History. By the spring of 1865, the Union armies ranged at will across the South. The Civil War was all but over, but resistance remained strong. And no city or town was more defiant than Richmond, the Confederate capital. As our guest this week, Nelson Langford, points out, the capture and burning of Richmond did not win the war for the Union, but it did represent the final crushing blow to the Confederacy. It also sowed the seeds of resentment that Southerners harbored toward the North for the next 100 years. Nelson Langford is the author of Richmond Burning, The Last Days of the Confederate Capital, published by Penguin Books. Welcome, Nelson.
Glad to be here, Brian.
Well, thanks for joining us. Let me start with an obvious question, or at least I think it is, which is, why did the Confederacy choose as its capital a city so close to Union lines rather than a more protected, deeper South?
Well, it was indeed only 100 miles from the Union capital, but you have to remember, the Confederacy began as the secession of the Deep South states, which had very little industry and only a small portion of the total white population of the South. And they wanted to get the Upper South states to join them. So one thing to do would be to offer to move the capital to Richmond, which was the most industrial city in the South. And that helped appeal to the secessionists in the Upper South. And, of course, it gave the Confederacy an industrial base it didn't have before. But it put the capital within striking distance of Washington, but vice versa.
So there was no dissension in the ranks and in the Deep South to have Richmond so far north and being a commercial city.
Well, there were other contenders wanting to be the capital, but I think the Southerners realized that in order to gain the adherence of those Upper South states, they're willing to have Richmond the capital of the Confederacy.
Okay, and what was the impact, then, of choosing Richmond to become the capital?
Well, for the people of Richmond, it dramatically changed life. Richmond was a city of about 40,000 people before the war, and it almost tripled in size during the war, with a massive influx of government bureaucrats and contractors and soldiers, lots of strangers. It changed the city dramatically. People didn't know who their neighbors were anymore.
Well, I want to come back to the impact on life, especially at the end of the war, but let me ask you first sort of one of these obvious questions. Why did it take so long, or perhaps another way of putting it, how come the Capitol survived for so long when it was so close to Union lines?
Well, it looks like a short distance as the crow flies, but there are lots of rivers between Washington and Richmond, and there was a lot of fighting that was away from Virginia for a long time. Some people would say the war was actually won in the West as the Union forces opened the Mississippi to their side and closed it to the Confederates. But as the war wore on, you can see the battles inching closer and closer to Richmond.
Do you think Grant had any choice? Could he have just ordered a full-scale assault on the city in the early months of, say, 65?
Grant, he was interested in crushing the armies opposed to him rather than taking territory, and so he was angling to defeat Robert E. Lee's Army of Northern Virginia. It just happened that he cornered Lee in the Central Virginia area, and there was a siege around Richmond and Petersburg, which was a small town below Richmond. So Grant was after the Confederate Army more than he was the capital, and Richmond happened to be there. My story takes place in Richmond. What happened in Richmond at the end of the war? The military action was sort of off stage from the focus of my story. Grant and Lee fighting it out below Richmond, and then Richmond becomes, as the Confederate Army leaves, then Richmond is open to occupation by the Union Army. There wasn't a lot of fighting between soldiers in the taking of Richmond.
Okay, so then let's deal with that, life in Richmond. First, tell us about how life in Richmond changed toward the end of the war before it finally fell.
Before the city fell, people were beginning to feel the pinch. Even the most diehard Confederates could see in daily life that although no one starved, people were hungry, and the variety of supplies and food that came in diminished, and life was hard. They're actually jumping ahead a bit. One of the Union officers remarked when he came into the city that people are glad to see us here, not so much from any Union sentiment, but because they've suffered so much. And that was true. Whether they were diehard Confederates or secret Union sympathizers, people were worn down with privation by April of 1865.
Okay. Now, one of the final blows is clearly when Lee's defeated at Fort Stedman, and then he abandons the city, and on April 2nd, Confederate President Jefferson Davis and members of his government flee as well. But you have an interesting story about one person who stays behind, John Campbell. In fact, I found this probably one of the more interesting parts of the book. Could you tell us a little bit about him and what he did?
John Campbell was a fascinating person. He had been an Associate Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court before the Civil War. He had actually tried to negotiate between the Confederates and the Lincoln government to prevent war from breaking out in April of 1861, and he failed, of course. Then he joined the Confederacy, became the Assistant Secretary of War under Jefferson Davis, and was the highest-ranking Confederate official left in Richmond when the Confederates left and the Union Army marched in. Campbell actually met Abraham Lincoln in Richmond and tried to negotiate with him because, you know, Lincoln arrived in Richmond only a day after the Union Army occupied it. And there was John Campbell trying to negotiate from a position of weakness. He tried to encourage Lincoln to call the Virginia legislature into session, and Lincoln agreed to do that. His purpose was to call the Virginia legislature together just to take Virginia out of the Confederacy and hasten the end to the war. But Lincoln almost tripped up here because he was giving Confederate officials some sort of recognition by allowing the legislature to convene. Nothing, of course, came of this. Appomattox happened before anything could happen. But it was a fascinating little diplomatic incident between John Campbell and Abraham Lincoln in the week after Richmond fell.
It really is very interesting, and clearly one of the strengths of this book is your descriptive power. I mean, it's a history, but it comes across so well in vivid imagery, and I think one area that, or one particular part you might want to talk about, and you have Richmond falling, the city's burning, there's chaos in the city, and in comes the Union troops. Tell us about the entrance of the Union troops.
There was a small Union army east of Richmond, and it was designated with the task of occupying Richmond. On the day the city fell, the Confederate rear guard, under orders, set fire to government-owned tobacco in a few warehouses by the waterfront, and they set fire to the last bridges across the James River. Unfortunately for them, a stiff wind arose and blew the fires out of control and destroyed the business district of the city just as the advance regiments of the Union Army came in. There are lots of stories, fascinating stories, about that day. There's a story of the rivalry between black and white Union regiments to try to be the first to enter Richmond. There was a story about who really raised the first American flag over the Capitol. And, of course, there were lots of claimants for that. And the story of who the last Confederates were to march across the last bridge before it burned across the river. It was a chaotic day and a fearful day for the residents. Even the minority who welcomed the Union Army, it was a frightening time to see their city burn.
Enter Lincoln the next day. Pretty gutsy move. Why did he do it again, and what was the response to his arrival?
Now, Lincoln was close at hand. He wasn't in Washington. A few weeks before, he had decided he wanted to meet with his commander, General Grant, and Grant's headquarters was at a place called City Point, which is now Hopewell, Virginia, which is a few miles downstream from Richmond. So he was on the spot when, in a sense, all hell broke loose and Grant's army began to follow Lee's army as it retreated to the west. Lincoln knew that the city of Richmond had fallen, but he and his advisors didn't know if it was militarily secure. But he still wanted to see the city. So he boarded a gunboat, and in fact he went with a flotilla of gunboats from City Point for the few miles upriver to Richmond. But one by one the gunboats had engine trouble, or they ran into obstructions, or they were just too big to get by Confederate barriers in the river. Lincoln just wanted to continue, and he progressively moved from larger to smaller boats till he ended up coming to Richmond in an admiral's barge, really just a big rowboat. And his security detail was left behind, wringing their hands, standing on the decks of their gunboats as the president disappeared upriver. You can imagine what would happen to the Secret Service today. So there he is, Abraham Lincoln, arriving in Richmond to the burned waterfront, and very quickly a crowd of African-American freedmen crowd around him and salute him and cheer him as he marches around the burned district and up through town to Jefferson Davis's mansion, which is, he knew at that point, that was going to be where the Union general in command would have his headquarters. And so Lincoln marches to Davis's house and sits in Jefferson Davis's chair maybe 36 hours after the Confederate president had left. Very dramatic stuff.
Dramatic indeed. You make a point that the burning of Richmond marked the beginning of the romanticization of the Old South and its ideals. What was that viewpoint, and how romanticized versus historical reality was it?
Well, one of the things you have to remember is that we have a wonderful visual record of the ruins of Richmond. There were photographers and journalists with the Union Army who came in shortly thereafter and began to take pictures and sell them as souvenirs to Northerners mainly. Those images of Richmond in ruins signified loss to the South and failed rebellion to the North for decades after the Civil War. So Richmond became a symbol, and all of the hurt and anguish that the Southern people felt at the defeat of their cause, in a sense, a repository for that would be to focus on, look at what happened to Richmond. There were people, even before the ashes had cooled, who were making arguments about how the South was crushed by superior military force and vowed that America would never be unified. In fact, the day after Richmond burned, an editor in Chicago said something, I can't remember exactly the quotation, but he said something like, the future unity of America will date from the 3rd of April when the Union flag was planted on the battlements of Richmond. Well, when that Chicago editor wrote that, the last Confederate newspaper in Richmond said something like this. He said, the editor said, after what has happened for the past 4 years, the future unity of America is a dream of maniacs. And that was the sentiment of a lot of diehard Confederates for a long time. And it took a long time, and it took a lot of selective forgetting and remembering on both sides before that unity came about. But thank God it did, because who would today object to that unity? But it was a long time in coming for generations.
Right. Clearly, and that really does sum it up. I think those were two great quotes, and including yours as well. We don't have time to go into it, but anyone starting to read your book will be struck, I think, as well by your very vivid portrayal of Robert E. Lee's return to Richmond. You actually start your book with it, but it really takes place at the end. And you want to very quickly comment on that?
Well, Lee came back to Richmond, I think it was 6 days after Appomattox, the 15th of April, 1865. And remember, this was the first view he had of Richmond in ruins. He hadn't seen the evacuation or the fire because he was retreating with his army earlier. This was the first view he had of the ruins of the capital city. And he arrived, people came out on the streets and began to wave to him, and gradually more and more people came out on the streets. When he reached his home, or the house that his family was renting, the crowd asked him to give a speech, but he refused to, and he went inside.
Interesting.
And the people in the crowd didn't know it, but the very time that they were saluting Lee, the Union military had received word over the telegraph that Lincoln had been shot the night before. So it was a very dramatic moment in the history of Richmond.
Great. And I'm afraid that's where we'll have to end it, but thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to Nelson Lankford, the author of Richmond Burning, The Last Days of the Confederate Capital, published by Penguin Books. And this is Talking History. Historian Andrew Schockett was sufficiently provoked by charges that the Bush administration exposed the name of a CIA agent, thereby endangering the agent's life, that he looked into the history of White House scandals to see how the Bush scandal stacked up. He joins us this week to report what he found. Schockett is a professor of history at Bowling Green State University.
This past summer, apparently out of political motives, high Bush administration officials exposed the name of CIA agent Valerie Plume to columnist Robert Novak. For 2 months, the president did nothing to investigate or even denounce this serious breach of national security. In the long list of presidential scandals, it's the first time a president has condoned, essentially, an act of treason. Not that there's a shortage of past White House shenanigans. Presidents and their underlings have defied the Supreme Court, lied to Congress, and spied on their political enemies. The most sensational presidential scandals have been about, what else? Sex. In 1831, Andrew Jackson's Secretary of War, John Eaton, dated and married a purported prostitute. Most of Jackson's cabinet resigned over the furor. Grover Cleveland raised eyebrows in 1886 by marrying 21-year-old Frances Folsom. Bill Clinton's peccadillo with Monica Lewinsky and his subsequent denials led to his impeachment. Greed generated other scandals. Ulysses Grant's vice president, Schuyler Colfax, accepted corporate stocks for supporting federal land giveaways to railroad companies in 1873. Warren Harding, Secretary of the Interior, pocketed $300,000 in 1921 in exchange for giving two shady oil men access to national petroleum reserves. Then there's Andrew Johnson's 1867 political miscalculation, which was more farcical than treasonable. By firing Secretary of War Edwin Stanton, Johnson violated the recently passed Tenure of Office Act. Johnson came within one vote of being removed from office for breaking a bizarre law later declared unconstitutional. The two scandals closest to rivaling the current one's gravity occurred under Presidents Nixon and Reagan. In the mid-1980s Iran-Contra affair, White House operatives defied Congress's prohibition against funding Nicaraguan Contra rebels and Reagan's own policy forbidding negotiations with terrorists. Hoping to curry favor with terrorist groups, Reagan officials secretly sold missiles to Iran and used the proceeds to buy guns for the Contras. In the ensuing mess, administration members lied to Congress. Their actions were stupid and illegal, but not dangerous to American lives. Pure politics plunged Nixon into machinations potentially undermining the nation's political system. In 1972, Nixon's political operatives broke into Democratic National Headquarters in the Watergate Hotel, thus giving us an enduring political term. They then lied about it, and Nixon resisted a judge's order and congressional inquiries before resigning to avoid impeachment. In this litany of presidential scandals, the Bush administration's crime is the first that put the lives of American public servants in danger. By allowing members of his administration to pursue petty political ends while endangering the nation, President Bush has sullied the presidency more than any of his predecessors.
You've been listening to Andrew Schockett, professor of history at Bowling Green State University. Schockett's commentary comes to us courtesy of the History News Service. And finally, we leave you with another segment in our series of Oval Office conversations, courtesy of the New Press. This week, we eavesdrop on a conversation between President Richard Nixon and White House Chief of Staff H.R. Haldeman on June 23, 1972. It's popularly known as the smoking gun tape because its discovery led to charges being brought against Nixon and his resignation from the presidency. On June 17, 1972, five men were arrested in the Democratic National Committee headquarters at the Watergate in Washington, D.C. Within days, the investigation of what some at first dismissed as a third-rate burglary led to the White House and the committee to re-elect the president. In this private Oval Office conversation, Nixon agrees with Haldeman's suggestion that they use the CIA to stop the FBI's investigation. Here's a small part of that conversation.
On the investigation, you know, the Democratic break-in thing, we're back in the problem area because the FBI is not under control because Gray doesn't exactly know how to control it. And they have, their investigation is now leading into some productive areas because they've been able to trace the money, not through the money itself, but through the bank, you know, sources, the banker itself, and it goes some directions we don't want it to go. Also, there have been some things like an informant came in off the street to the FBI in Miami where a photographer who has a friend who's a photographer who develops leaders that the only way to solve this, and we're set up beautifully to do it, in that, and that's the only network that paid me attention to last time was NBC, who did a massive story on the Cuban thing and all. That the way to handle this now is for us to have Walters call Pat Gray and just say, stay the hell out of this. This is a business here. We don't want you working any further on. That's not an unusual development. And that would take care of Pat Gray. Pat does want to. He doesn't know how to, and he doesn't have any basis for doing it. Given this, he will then have the basis. He'll call Mark Bell and the two of them, and Mark Bell wants to cooperate because he's ambitious.
Yeah.
They'll call them in and say, we've got to sail across the river to put the hold on this. And that'll fit rather well because the FBI agents who are working the case at this point feel that's what it is.
You've been listening to a conversation between Richard Nixon and H.R. Haldeman that took place in the Oval Office on June 23, 1972. Permission to play the recording was given by the New Press, which has published a collection of White House tapes in a companion book under the same title. And that brings us to the end of another week of Talking History. As always, we welcome your comments on this program or suggestions for future shows, which you can send us by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or by regular mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Joey Skidmore, producer. Fiona Beatty, assistant producer. To learn more about Talking History or the OAH, visit our website at oah.org. A Moment in Time is produced by Dan Roberts and distributed by WCVE-FM in Richmond, Virginia. For more information, visit amomentintime.com. And finally, the Organization of American Historians and Talking History would like to recognize and thank Michael J. Spector for his generous support. Until next week, this is your host, Brian Lavelle.